Good morning and welcome to the February 19, 2019 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission. I want to thank everyone for coming today and a reminder to please silence your cell phones or any other electronic devices that you may have with you today. Today's meeting is both a study and a business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10:03 and the afternoon business session starting around 1 o'clock. We welcome the public's input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that when you come to the microphone to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have four commissioners present. Commissioner Congdon is away conducting district business. Attending is General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Garfin. So please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have anyone doing a safety meeting this morning?
Tim's going to
Tim?
Us.
All right, Tim.
All right.
Are we on?
Yeah. We are.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mr. Wright, Tim Pettit, Director of Safety and HPI here at the district. And this is a very condensed down version of some of the changes that we're making here at the district to try to make sure that our human performance improvement initiative is being driven through the district. So this is a quick look of what our employees are seeing at our safety meetings. And so at every single safety meeting now, we're trying to give real world examples from here at the district of what HPI means to us. And although HPI is not a safety initiative, it'll also reflect on how it supports safety here at the district. So again, human performance improvement, the district has made a very significant investment and focus on this, and we believe that this is truly the path to be on to get us better. And the five principles behind human performance are: we're human, we all make errors. Actually, the numbers are at least 1 to 7 an hour. Some of us can tend to drive that up a little bit. But the errors, they truly are reoccurring and predictable. If we make a mistake or an error, you can rest assured it's not the first time that that was made. So curiosity should really drive us to take a look at those errors when we make them and figure out what's happening here. And as employees, as members of the community, they really are the people that can figure out why we're making those errors. And one of the other biggest things is once we figure that out, is how do we build in defenses and strategies behind those defenses so that even though as humans we're going to continue to make errors, how do we reduce the effects of those errors so that they don't injure us? So we're trying to build in those defenses. So I'll set up a quick synopsis behind what occurred here. As federal laws and state laws change for weight distributions on our trucks, they continue to get bigger and larger and larger. And so this HPI moment you're going to see is one of our trucks. We were actually headed south on South Wenatchee Avenue. There was an aid unit that was coming north. We were in the inside lane, so the driver turned on his blinkers, checked his mirrors, looked back in his mirror again, and made the move over to the outside lane. All he actually heard was tires squealing, and he didn't know what the problem was. So he touched the brakes on our big line truck, and the car shot out from in front of him. He was actually pushing the vehicle down South Wenatchee Avenue. He'd pit maneuvered it and didn't even know it occurred because of the blind spot that was there.
Wow.
So rather than, as would have happened years ago, come in, stern discussion, possibly a letter in the file, you need to be more careful, you can look on YouTube. This happens every day all over. So it's, okay, why did this happen? As an employee, you're the solution. Let's figure this out. So we looked at it different. There was no discipline. It was strictly a learning exercise, which is where we're going as a district. We want to learn from these. Granted, if they're illegal, malicious, we're going to look at it differently. But we need to learn from our issues. And so this is one of the things that we did. This is the actual truck. And this is our safety coordinator with a GoPro on it at eye level. And so as we were walking through this process to figure out how did this happen and why did this happen? And what you'll notice is when he was in that truck, you couldn't see any of those cones or the car there.
Oh my gosh.
That's how large those blind spots become as the trucks continue to grow in size and height. And is that it'll walk through a few more scenarios here. But as we studied this, we talked to the employees. Many of you are familiar, especially the commissioners and Steve and many of you, where we take these vehicles. So a lot of the solves for these issues are large mirrors that go on the hoods, convex mirrors that you can see. Well, in the areas we take these trucks, that's not feasible because you'd tear them off and have to damage the truck more. So we took a look and thought, okay, how do we fix this issue? So we came up with blind spot cameras. The rear view mirrors in these trucks are of no use because the trucks have booms on them and we have the backs are full. So we purchased blind spot cameras on our new trucks and we retrofitted some of these old ones so that when you turn your blinker on, it shows up in your rear view mirror. So now you hit your blinker to move into the right-hand lane and you can see what's in that right-hand lane. We really thought we had taken care of that issue. And this moves more into human performance of sometimes your first solve isn't always the best. What we have found out, especially here lately, as our crews assisted on the west side in heavy rain, very dark circumstances, when you turn that blinker on and that blind spot comes up, it actually can blind you in the truck. So we took another look.
Because of the brightness?
Because of the brightness in the rear view mirror, it kind of shocks you at night. Especially what we found is on the west side in the pouring down rain, it's worse. So we actually just purchased one of these. It's on the truck now. We're testing it. And this is another item that we purchased to try to solve that problem. So what this is it's a radar sensing unit. And you'll see it here. They'll show it here in a minute. It goes on the sides of your trucks in strategic locations, and it will not pick up stationary items. So if you have guardrails, if you have other items, jersey barriers, it will not send the signal at that time. It will only pick up difference in movement. And it sends off a little alarm inside the truck so that you know there's a vehicle in the blind spot. Now, many of our new vehicles, even the ones you purchase are passenger vehicles, have this option on them. Our large trucks do not. And so this was another item. As I said, we purchased it. We are checking out the viability of it now as we continue to move through this process. I realize this is a safety minute, so I better wrap this up. But one of the things is I'd like to say thank you to the board and to the general manager for supporting this movement into, it's a new culture, it's a mindset of how we look at things differently and we think about things differently. And when there's something that occurs, we first look at how do we learn from it. And like I said, it's different if it's illegal, immoral, unethical. We'll still look at things in a different fashion, but you don't punish the human out of us. And we're human and we make errors. So allowing us to move into this culture, supporting it, I'm not sure what the district could do beyond that to say, hey, what goes on here at the district's important. We care about our employees. We care about the safety and human performances throughout the district, whether you're in the crafts turning wrenches or you're on the clerical side and decimal points, spellings get put in the wrong place. Human performance is about looking at all the errors we make and how we can reduce those errors to a reasonable and acceptable amount. So,
great.
That's great.
That was good. Great.
Very good.
So, Tim, you know, just a question. I've got a relatively new car that's got a lot of what you're talking about here. In very bad weather, sometimes the weather itself renders the devices incapable of sensing. Is that being factored in as you guys wander down this path? You know, they'll tell you, in my car, it'll tell you if it's not working.
Yeah, we're actually hoping to have both options, and the rear view mirror would just have a cover that goes over it at the times when it's not feasible to be using it. The blind spot detectors definitely in heavy snow when they get covered. There's issues. That's why we continually, as employees and management, we continue to work together to try to find solves. And again, human performance is not going to create an errorless society, but we're hoping to build in the factors that when we do make those errors, we don't injure somebody, and the damage that we may do to equipment stuff becomes much, much less and actually, you know, reasonable for the type of work that we're doing.
Yeah.
Really appreciate the support, and I know there's a lot of support and excitement here at the district as we move into this. So hopefully each month we'll be showing you things that have occurred here at the district and how we're learning from the support you've given us. So.
Yeah, it's just good public policy not to pit the public with our line trucks.
And like I say, you look at that 10 years ago,
yeah,
been a letter in a file, and you need to be safer. You need to be more aware. Well, it's going to happen again because the same exact issues.
Exactly. So. But the video was a great illustration, and I appreciate that, you know, visual. Because now you're sitting in that cab, and you understand the position that we were putting our employees in, and it's our obligation to create a fix, not to put our employees in that position. Because who ultimately then is at fault? You know, and that would be the policymakers for not having acted appropriately. So, again, thank you for the follow-up on that.
Absolutely, and thank you for your guys' support.
Great. Great job, Tim.
Thank you.
I did want to say that this is the first of what will be a series of presentations this way. So we're changing the way we're going to be describing safety minutes here. Tim has brought a lot of new energy to his role and some new ideas, which has been fantastic. One of them is that for the monthly safety meetings, there will be specific examples from issues that have occurred here at the district.
Yeah.
And so he will be bringing those here as well. So what you would expect to see is, of course, we have two meetings a month. The off meeting, we'll be doing the same thing as we've done before. We'll have employees coming in and talking about safety issues. But one of our meetings per month, Tim will be coming in and describing what our employees are seeing.
Great.
In terms of an issue that has come up in the workplace that we're working on.
Great. Really good.
Yeah.
One other small thing is, these are shown at every single safety meeting throughout the entire district, so we're trying to get a very consistent message. And for, again, lack of a better term, water cooler conversations, people will have something in common to talk about how this is changing the district and how it's changing how we think. So you guys will be seeing the same message that every single employee in the district is seeing at the safety meeting. So it gives us a commonality to sit and talk about and discuss. Really look forward to it.
Perfect.
Great.
And hopefully you can also see how Tim's doing a great job of connecting a safety minute to what we're trying to get to with HPI as well. I mean, just
there's a bridge. Yeah. You can see it.
There is a bridge. Yeah.
Nice job.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim. So we have, Steve, I'm just going to turn over to you about the consent agenda.
So here's what I'd like to suggest, that we have three items on the agenda, 14, 15, and 16, which have been discussed at previous board meetings, and they were eligible for public comment. We didn't receive public comment at our public hearing last time. We have not received any written public comment so far. My suggestion would be to place them on consent, but just ask a question at 1 o'clock as to whether there's anyone here that wants to provide public comment, in which case we could pull it off. But assuming that that's unlikely and doesn't happen, then it would just stay on consent, if that's all right with the board.
14, 15, and 16?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Works fine.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we add to the consent agenda items 14, 15, and 16 with the contingency that at our regular meeting, should there be someone from the public who would like to discuss any of those, that we do so.
I'd second that.
I move to second it. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And I probably should have said those are all implementation of our cryptocurrency policies. And so that's why we've had a heck of a lot of discussion about that. So that's why we don't expect to get a public comment at this point.
Okay. It's been approved unanimously, so we'll move on.
Okay. Ready to go? So I want to invite Arnie Olson to come up. So I want to take a moment. Arnie is super smart guy, I'll start with that, and also a good friend from a long time back that has been heavily involved in thinking through West Coast electricity policy, and particularly as states pursue decarbonization, deep decarbonization policies. We began working with him many years ago. We feel honored to be able to work with him. We are fortunate in that he is from East Wenatchee, and so we actually have some linkages here that have been able to draw him to come to town and work with us. He is heavily used by publicly owned utilities, investor-owned utilities, environmental groups, regulatory agencies, all of whom rely on him to be able to provide an objective view of how different policies might impact how the Western electric power system operates. And we're quite proud of the work that he has done for us and for the public generating pool, because it's allowed us to be a player in the discussions in Olympia around some of these big issues regarding clean electricity policy. And we feel like it's led us to be more successful in that arena too. In fact, I'll come back at the end and say a little bit about how we think things have changed as a result of these studies and Arnie's representation of us in Olympia as well. So with that, we welcome Arnie and look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Well, thanks, Steve, and thanks, commissioners. As a hometown kid, I can't tell you how much it actually means to me to be able to come and talk to you about the exciting work that we've been doing together with Steve, so I really appreciate the opportunity. There's a lot of material here. I'm not going to go through all of it in detail. There's plenty of more backup material if you'd like, and I've provided links here to the detailed studies that we've done. Today I'm going to summarize two studies that we've worked on over the last couple of years. Now, there was one that was sponsored by the Public Generating Pool Group, of which the district is a member, in 2017, finished up a little over a year ago. And then there was that one was looking at what are the least cost ways to reduce carbon emissions in the electricity sector in the Pacific Northwest. Then there was a follow-up, I think as Steve mentioned, that in our least cost study, we didn't really look in depth at how you might make sure that there's a system that can provide reliable electric service, even under heavy reliance on wind and solar and under a deeply decarbonized grid. So the follow-up was looking more directly at that question of reliability, resource adequacy. What kind of resources would you need to make sure that you could continue to provide the level of reliable electric service that we've all come to depend on? So much more of a detailed study. Anyway, there's the links. I'm going to go through kind of physically what we see happening on the grid. I'm going to attempt to paint for you a picture of what this grid would look like. It's very different from the one that we know today, this grid that relies heavily on wind and solar and really strains to meet load during the most challenging times of the year. And then kind of back up from there to understand what the costs of establishing that type of a system might be, what the impact on emissions would be, and then what the conclusions that we draw from it for policymakers and for resource planners in the region. So the sponsors, I want to put a shout out to them first, of course. As I said, the study in 2017 was sponsored by the PGP Group. The one last year was joined by Puget Sound Energy, Avista, and Northwestern Energy in Montana. And I want to take a moment here to mention that really this all got started with a little study that we worked on with Steve and that this district funded in 2015-16 kind of a time frame, where Steve asked us to cull from the studies that we had done in other jurisdictions, what are some lessons learned? California has looked deeply at how they can reduce carbon across the California economy. New York, Maryland, we've been involved with the United Nations and some nationwide studies. The Northwest is a little bit different. We have a heavy reliance on hydropower. We have a lot of electric heating in the Northwest already. We have a winter peaking system. So we Steve asked us to kind of call from those other studies, what are some lessons that we could apply to the Northwest? So we learned that the role of the hydro system is really important in the Northwest. We learned that the winter peak has a big impact on what our solutions look like, our resource base. So that was a useful and interesting study, and I want to commend the district in having, I think, the foresight to sponsor that type of research into these policy questions, which, you know, might shape the future of the district and of the other systems in the region. I think we also learned that we needed more information. We needed to dive more deeply into what the specific characteristics of the Northwest electricity system are and how that shapes the result, both what the portfolio looks like and what the cost implications are. So that's what led to the follow-up studies. So just to paint the picture here, Washington and Oregon have both, over the past several years and increasingly intensively in Salem and Olympia, been looking at how should the states reduce carbon emissions in line with the international goals of 80% reductions below 1990 levels. And Oregon has even been looking at up to 91% below 1990 levels. So that on the top right is a chart of what historical emissions look like across the economies for both Washington and Oregon, and what the reduction trajectory would need to be by 2050 to get down to 80% reductions below 1990 levels. As you can see, it's quite a steep reduction, that trajectory. That's going to have big impacts on the economy and on the built environment and on the energy infrastructure. Those studies were conceived to provide some useful, technical, unbiased information to policymakers about what that might look like for us. So what's the least cost way to reduce carbon in the electricity sectors in Washington and Oregon? How do we maintain reliable electric service, even under systems that are heavily reliant on wind and solar? And what's the importance of the region's existing base of zero carbon resources, including the hydro, including the nuclear assets, et cetera? One thing to understand about the Northwest is that we already are in a very enviable position from the perspective of everybody else in the world. So we already have, when you add it up, 73% of our energy, electricity, comes from zero carbon sources due to the large base of hydro. But then also we already have a fair amount of wind in the region, and we have a large nuclear station. So coal and natural gas are the sources of carbon emissions. Those only provide about 27% of the emissions in the Northwest region. And of those, there are about exactly nine coal-fired power plants which serve load in the Northwest, which together are responsible for 80% of the carbon emissions that are attributable to Washington and Oregon. There are 16 natural gas plants, so more, almost double the number of plants, but they only produce 20% of the carbon emissions in the region. So really, to reduce carbon in the Northwest, you want to replace the coal. And if you can replace the coal with some form of zero carbon energy and keep the gas right about where it's at today, then you've achieved an 80% reduction below 1990 levels. So that's where we have to get to. There are already some of the plants that are announced for retirement. The Colstrip 1 and 2 units in Montana are scheduled to be retired in 2023-24 timeframe. The Centralia coal plant on the west side, part of that shuts down in 2020, part of it in 2024, and the Boardman plant in Oregon. And we anticipate a number of additional announcements to come in the next several years. So we're kind of already moving in this direction just based on cost reasons. But the policies then would anticipate an acceleration of that and specification of replacement with zero carbon forms of energy. So we modeled different ways, different policies to achieve the carbon emission reductions. And you'll see there are some very interesting differences in depending on how the policy is written in Olympia. So every study has to have a reference case. This is just the least cost way to serve load all the way out through 2050, taking into consideration current policy. Then we looked at some cases where we capped the amount of carbon that the electricity sector was allowed to emit. and I'm going to focus on that 80% reduction case by 2050. We also looked at two carbon tax cases, and these were the specific proposals that were out there in 2017 and 2016, issued by Governor Inslee and by the Democratic leaders in the legislature. I'm not going to focus on those today. They behave exactly like the carbon cap cases. They both serve to put a price on carbon and make you make it less desirable to produce electricity from a carbon-emitting source and more desirable to invest in sources that don't emit carbon. So by placing a price on carbon, it drives and changes in operations and investment for the system. We looked at cases where we just raised the RPS, so to 30, 40, and 50%. And I'll show you that 50% RPS case and how extreme that case looks compared to a moderate case like a carbon cap case. And then we focus a little bit on the role of natural gas. So there's been a sense that if you just squeeze off the ability to generate from natural gas, so if we don't allow any new natural gas plants to be built, then maybe that will force us to start relying on zero carbon sources of power instead. And what we find actually is that natural gas plays a really critical role all the way out through 2050, even under a deeply decarbonized power grid. I'll get into this in some depth, but it's quite simply because the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine, there's not always as much water as you would like in the river, and if you don't have some other source of lots of zero carbon power in the times when you need it, and you can't serve your load reliably. And so the cure to that is to make sure that we have enough natural gas capacity that can turn on when you really need the power, but then you have enough other sources of zero carbon power to make sure that you don't run that natural gas very much. So that's, in a nutshell, how we can maintain a reliable electric system that is also deeply decarbonized. But I think that role for natural gas is not widely understood by the environmental community or by the policy community. So that's been one of our key messages, is we need to still have that firm, reliable capacity, because there will be times when we need it, and those are the times when we really want to have it, because that's when it's cold outside.
So may I ask a question?
Yeah.
In terms of having that amount of gas available, just want to use the one word, capacity. Mm-hmm. What kind of consideration is being given to, whether it be public or private, investment in capacity to meet that goal? Is there consideration for how that's going to work out? Because if there's no economic incentive to maintain that level of capacity, why would anyone want to do it? So I don't know if you're going to get to that, but that's kind of a spot for me that needs to be scratched.
Yeah, no, it's a really important question. What our studies have done is just identified what the system needs to look like.
Okay.
And there's a set of follow-up questions, which are, what are the policy, economic, okay, regulatory mechanisms,
right,
that you would need to have to make that system come about, right?
Okay.
Clearly, there needs to be some form of, you know, ratepayer payment to, mm-hmm, to a low-capacity factor natural gas plant, a peaker plant, basically. And so whether that's through utility ownership or through a power purchase agreement, you know, it could be either way. But it's not different from how the Southwest has maintained reliability for years. You know, when it gets really, really hot, they turn on peaker plants, and they don't run very often 5% capacity factor. Mm-hmm. But again, when it's really hot in the Southwest, you really want to have those plants to turn on. So we end up needing that same type of a resource in the Northwest, whereas in the past, we've mostly relied on hydro to provide that service.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to take you exactly to this picture, because I hopefully this will help to illustrate the challenge that we face here. So what I've shown you here, this is where all the squiggles are. So.
Yep, that's right.
So I'm going to try to walk you through the squiggles. So we've got 10 days, a 10-day stretch that we picked out. Not, it's meant to be the most challenging 10 days, but so it's a new winter time. The black squiggles are the electric load on an hourly basis. You can see it's low at night. And then there's a peak in the morning when everyone gets up and turns on their showers and such. It drops down at noon, comes back up in the evening. That's a fairly typical Northwest winter peak load shape. The gray area at the bottom, so on this grid, we're trying to meet all of our energy needs with just zero carbon sources. So on the bottom there is dispatchable generation. So that's nuclear. Okay, the blue is hydro. You can see it varies a lot because we're shaping the hydro system to the needs of the system. So we're moving the water around to where we need it the most. Then the green is our renewable sources. So that's wind and solar. Okay. And those obviously vary a lot. They vary from hour to hour. They vary from day to day. The sun doesn't shine at all at night. It might be a surprise to some, but that's so we need something at night. The wind can vary from day to day. So if you really want to serve all of this energy need with zero carbon power, you have to basically fill up that entire area below that black line with something that's zero carbon. And if the vast majority of your energy depends on the weather, then it's hard because, there are some times when you just don't have enough. So the only way that you can solve that problem with wind and solar is to build your system so large that even during the most challenging times, you have enough of the resource. So that area there, so take a look at day 5. Now you see that load goes way up. So this is a cold snap that comes through the region. Now it happens that when it's cold across the whole region, it's also cold on the west side, so there's no air moving through the gorge. So it happens that when it's cold here, there's not very much wind generation. It's in the winter, so there's not very much. Even if it's sunny, there's only a couple of hours a day, so the solar doesn't help you that much either. So it happens that our peak load tends to coincide with low renewable production, and it happens for several days in a row. So you can see that on day 2 and 3, I had to build the system so big that I have way more wind and solar than I need on days 2 and 3. I can store some of that, and the purple there on day 5 is then discharging my batteries, right? But the batteries run out in the middle of day 6. Now I've got 3 days in a row where I have loss of, I just don't have enough stuff. All my batteries are depleted. There's not very much wind and solar generation. It's a low hydro year. The hydro's doing all it can, and I just don't have enough to serve load. And it's not just a small problem. If you look at the size of that, the vertical size of that red wedge, it's 30,000 megawatts. So I'm not just, not able to serve a couple of industrial customers. If you send the college home, for a couple of days, that helps. But here you've got, a third to maybe 40% of the load that you can't serve with this system. This is a big, big challenge. Now, of course, if you had natural gas, you could just turn that on. And in days 5 through 8, you run some gas that helps you to fill that hole. And as long as you don't do that very often, it doesn't create that much carbon emissions. That really is the antidote to this, is I have to have something that I can turn on to help me get through these really challenging times. So this is, I think I'm going to skip past this one. That one's very technical. Okay, so just to give you a sense of what these systems look like. So here we're showing you the results of our cap and trade cases. And on the left-hand side is the reference case in 2050 and how much resource we've added. And on the right-hand side there is the 80% reduction case. So the cases get more stringent as you go from left to right. Okay, so in the reference case, we added about 9,000 megawatts of natural gas between now and 2050. That's the gray bar. The blue is wind, and the yellow is solar. So we've added a couple thousand megawatts of wind and a couple thousand megawatts of solar. So to get to an 80% reduction by 1990, below 1990 levels, turns out you have to add about 11,000 megawatts of wind and solar in our Washington, Oregon core region that we looked at. So that's enough to squeeze off the coal and reduce carbon emissions by 80% below 1990 levels. We also have to add, by 2050, 7,000 megawatts of new natural gas capacity. In part, that's because we're losing several thousand megawatts of coal, but we also have load that continues to grow between now and 2050, and wind and solar, again, don't really help us very much to serve load during the peak load conditions. So we end up adding new natural gas generation between now and 2050, even as we're reducing carbon emissions by 80% below 1990 levels. So new capacity, but less throughput, right? So that's what this system looks like. On the right-hand side here now, we see this is annual energy production. On the left-hand side is just the megawatts, steel in the ground, that we're adding. The right now is the energy balance. And that black line there is the load in 2050. So here's where we see the hydro show up, the light blue wedge of energy there is, you can see the dominant role of the hydro providing, again, about 60% of our energy. That dark blue wedge of wind is growing as you go from the least stringent to the most stringent case. The yellow wedge of solar is growing a little bit. But even more importantly, that black wedge of coal at the bottom, the coal generation is declining. So as the price on carbon increases, then it makes it more economic to use natural gas instead of coal. And eventually it makes it economic to invest in wind and solar. that's the dynamics that we're seeing on this system, is the price of carbon is rising. It allows us, it encourages us to use less coal, more natural gas, encourages us to invest in zero carbon sources of new energy. So hydro generation continues to be the dominant source. We find that wind and solar come online and slowly replace the coal over time. We maintain reliability through having enough natural gas capacity. And this is a case that meets our carbon goal at a relatively low cost. It's a very balanced system. It's a smooth transition between now and 2050. If instead we focus only on renewables and we use the RPS policy to drive investments in renewables, we find that system becomes unbalanced over time. So we can continue to add wind and solar, and to get to a 50% RPS, we find we would need to add 23,000 megawatts of wind and solar, so twice as much as we're adding, just to reduce carbon emissions to 80% below 1990 levels. We still need that 7,000 megawatts of new natural gas for reliability for the reasons we've talked about. Now on the right-hand side, you can see that the annual energy production starts to become unbalanced. It's that wind and solar give us lots and lots of energy, so much that we can't even use it all. So we end up exporting a lot of wind and solar power. We end up curtailing some of the wind and solar. And the system becomes overbuilt pretty quickly to what we would really need. And on the bottom, you can see that an RPS policy by itself doesn't drive the coal generation off the system. So you're ending up with lots and lots of wind and solar that we're exporting, we're spilling, but the coal generation is still running. So that's the challenge with an RPS. It really was meant to jumpstart the renewable industry, and it's done that very well. Those industries are now mature. But it doesn't focus on carbon. It only focuses on investing in new renewable power. It doesn't consider hydro, doesn't consider conservation, doesn't consider existing nuclear, which the nuclear facilities are struggling all across the country to continue to make money and to continue to run in a time when we're supposed to be focused on reducing carbon emissions.
Excuse me, Arnie, could you go back and repeat what you just said a moment ago about nuclear?
Yeah, if the main policy instrument for clean energy is nuclear, an RPS, so that focuses on wind, solar, geothermal, the favored new types of renewable resources, it doesn't focus typically on the older sources of zero carbon power like nuclear or hydro. And so if they're left out of the policy mechanism, then not only do they not get the subsidies that those other sources get, but the fact that there's more zero carbon wind and solar coming onto the grid makes it even more difficult for nuclear and hydro to make enough revenues in the marketplace to support the continued reinvestment that's required to keep them going.
So that just kind of sets aside the potential of modular nuclear.
Yeah, the RPS policies typically have small modular nuclear has not qualified for any state policy that I'm aware of.
So I'm just restating for understanding. So then any kind of subsidies that would create opportunity for new energy resources would not be under the scenario channeled toward modular nuke.
That's correct. Yeah, we're assuming here that it continues to be focused on wind, solar, geothermal.
Okay. So that brings up another question for me. Mm-hmm. And again, back to capacity. What is the remaining capacity for wind and solar? I mean, is there enough capacity remaining to meet this large, in your previous slide, green demand?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. There's no question that there's enough energy out there. So there's enough potential. The question is, are there enough places that where we can build it where people don't care, right?
Okay.
And can we build enough transmission from those specific locations to bring that energy to the load centers on the west side in particular? So that's the question that I have. These are very land-intensive resources. It feels like 11,000 megawatts, we ought to find enough places to put that. But I'm going to show you in a minute to actually get to 100% hydro, wind, and solar. We have to build 100,000 megawatts of new wind and solar. And I don't know if there's enough places to put all of that.
Okay. And not in my backyard. It's not considered.
Yeah, we're just assuming that you can build this stuff.
Okay. All right.
Big assumption, I know.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, I appreciate your patience, but I'm just trying to gain some understanding here, and I appreciate that.
No, those are great questions. Okay, so what if we just prohibit the construction of natural gas, and that's the only thing that we do. Does that drive us towards a clean energy future? What we find is that the cheapest way to replace the capacity that we would otherwise need is just to use energy storage, and it doesn't actually drive any new investment in renewables at all, because it's really not focused on energy. It's mostly focused on capacity. We know that wind and solar don't provide capacity. So it doesn't change the energy mix very much. The coal, in fact, the coal actually runs a little bit more in this case, because we find there are sometimes some days when you charge with coal at night and discharge during the daytime to displace natural gas, because that would be the economic thing to do. So this policy by itself is entirely ineffective at reducing carbon. All it really does is starve the system of the capacity that it needs to serve load reliably. And in our detailed follow-up, we found this system actually isn't reliable. You would need a lot more wind and solar than we're showing here to make sure that you could actually serve load reliably. So that's not a good strategy. Then could you actually get all the way to zero carbon with just wind and solar, and not considering nuclear or some of the other potential baseload zero carbon sources? We find we can make our model solve by adding, again, about 100,000 megawatts of new wind, solar, and batteries. You end up overbuilding the renewable portfolio to such an extent that you're curtailing or throwing away about half of the available renewable energy. That's that big red wedge on the right-hand side. Wow. In theory, you can make this work, but in practice, it really doesn't work. And then the last point I'll make before I go to summarize what we find in terms of the cost impacts is that the existing zero-carbon resources are really valuable, as you can imagine. The more stringent you make the greenhouse gas target, the more important and the more valuable it is to maintain the existing zero-carbon resources. So on the left-hand side there, we've shown you a scenario where we replace about 2,000 average megawatts of hydro and nuclear. So it's enough energy to be, you know, let's say that we didn't pick the four lower snake dams specifically, but it's about enough energy that the four lower snake dams would provide, plus the Columbia generating station, so about 2,000 average megawatts. To replace that under the reference case, just the least cost case, you'd replace that all with natural gas, so you'd build about 2,000 megawatts of natural gas. If you're trying to replace that while still maintaining your stringent carbon target, you'd have to build about 7,500 megawatts of resources total. So you have to build 5,000 megawatts of wind and solar, plus 2,000 megawatts of natural gas, because you still need that capacity that those resources were providing. So again, you're having to way overbuild the replacement resources to replace all of the energy and the capacity that you're losing if the hydro and nuclear go away. And just to give you a sense, increases the total cost of meeting the carbon goal by about $1.6 billion per year by 2050. So it's quite expensive. And just to give you a sense of, on the right-hand side, of how much more valuable those resources are under a stringent carbon target, the left-hand side I've shown you the cost of replacing that hydro and nuclear power in the reference case, so with no carbon target, it's about $61 a megawatt hour. So that's not just the energy, that's also the capacity and the flexibility and the ancillary, so all the services that the hydro and nuclear provide. You can't just look at the mid-sea price today and say that's a fair number to value the hydro system. Hydro system has all of these other attributes that aren't valued in that mid-sea market, which is really just surplus energy being traded back and forth between utilities in the Northwest. So the whole bundle of things costs $61 a megawatt hour to replace under the reference case. Under this carbon constrained case, it costs $91 a megawatt hour. That's the combination of wind, solar, and natural gas that you would have to build to replace the hydro and nuclear is about $91 a megawatt hour. So that's a fair value of what the hydro, you know, the valuation of the hydro, you know, out through 2050 under a carbon-constrained world. Okay, I'm just going to go through these, I think, fairly quickly, but just to give you a sense of what these portfolios then mean for cost and emissions on the system. So here we've got on the x-axis the carbon emission reductions relative to the reference case. So remember, the reference case was in or through 2050, just meeting load at least cost. Okay, so that's, you can see that that's the gray dot there at the origin. And then on the y-axis is the increase in cost. So that 80% reduction case costs about $1 billion per year more than the reference case. So it's not free to reduce the carbon emissions by 80% below 1990 levels. Costs about $1 billion more per year. Oops. And that's about a, if you were to average that across the entire region, would lead to maybe a 6% increase in average electric rates. So it's not free, but it's also not so expensive that it has to be prohibitive. Right? That number is not gonna dissuade any policymaker who really wants to act on carbon that they shouldn't do this. They'll look at this and say, this is something we think we can afford given how extreme the potential impacts are from climate change and our need to do something about it. This is the best case. This is how you do it at least cost. And you can see that as you get to go from 40 to 60 to 80%, the curve is trending upward, right? It's getting steeper and steeper and steeper as you make the carbon target more and more stringent. This line shows what happens with just an RPS policy. So if you just focus on renewables, then you spend more and you get less. And the main reason is because it's really not doing anything to help get you off of coal, which again is the source of 80% of the emissions in the region. It's just adding renewables to a system that doesn't necessarily even need them. So to get to a 50% RPS for the region costs about twice as much as our 80% carbon cap case, but it gets you about half as much emission reductions. So $2 billion per year and only 12 million metric tons of emission reductions. And then our new gas case we already talked about is really just not effective at all at reducing carbon. It just adds cost. So it also costs $1 billion, but it doesn't do very much at all to reduce carbon. So it seems pretty clear here that, you know, the best case is a broad-based policy that considers, that is focused on carbon, considers all the potential sources of carbon emission reductions, including energy efficiency, new renewables, nuclear, hydro, all of it. And then to show you what happens if you try to go all the way to 100% with just wind and solar. So now we're kind of in a different orbit, sort of like, you know, all the dots at the bottom are like Earth, Mars, you know, Venus, Mercury, and now we're into Jupiter. We get out here. So, you know, it's $18 billion per year is the incremental cost of building all the wind and solar that you would need to get to 100% zero carbon, carbon-free power grid in the Northwest. And so, you know, again, this is just, it's in theory it's possible, but it's prohibitive. And you certainly would be asking what you can do in buildings and vehicles and industry and, you know, offsets and all, you know, all kinds of other things before you would do this on the grid. And you know, this isn't just our study that's finding this. This is squarely in line with the literature that's out there in academia as well. There's any number of studies that come to the same conclusion looking at power systems around the world. So just to summarize then, we find that the lowest cost way to reduce carbon emissions in the grid is to replace coal with a combination of energy efficiency, renewables, and natural gas. And what that exact mix is, we're not saying that what we've shown here is the exact right mix. You know, that's going to evolve over time if you have a policy that's flexible enough to allow it to evolve. And that's where we think a price on carbon is the most efficient way to do this. It provides all the right signals to all the right entities, has all of the right resources factored into it. The more broad-based you can make that policy, that price, the more solutions you have at your disposal to reduce carbon emissions at a lower cost. It is possible. So the good news is it is possible to maintain reliable electric service and have a deeply decarbonized grid under the condition that you have enough firm capacity to turn on during those times when you really need it, during the cold snap, especially on the third and fourth day. For now, natural gas is the only technology that we have available to us commercially to help meet that need. In the future, maybe there'll be other ones. Maybe the small modular reactors will become economic. Maybe carbon capture using fossil generation, natural gas generation, and capturing all the carbon and burying it underground. Maybe there'll be some form of very long duration storage. Maybe there'll be some form of zero carbon methane, biomass-based natural gas, for example, or synthetic gas. But for now, we don't have those available. So we need natural gas for reliability. And that's a near-term issue, not just a long-term issue. It would be extremely costly and impractical to replace all carbon-emitting firm capacity with just solar, wind, and storage. We think renewables will play a critical role in the deeply decarbonized grid, but it's time for policy to turn from an RPS to something that's more broadly based and more focused on carbon. The RPS has unintended consequences and make it harder for hydro, nuclear, and conservation to play a role in the decarbonized future. Again, retiring existing hydro and nuclear generation makes it much more difficult to meet your carbon goals. And if you're thinking about the role, and whether you want to decommission one dam or one set of dams, it's not good enough to just look at that in isolation and say, yes, I can take these dams out and replace them with wind and storage and demand response. You need to think about what the impact is on the entire portfolio if you really are trying to reduce carbon emissions by that degree. It's a much different picture if you're thinking about the future where you're squeezing that much carbon out of the system and you're making your job much more difficult. We think we need new capacity in the near term. One thing we found in our reliability study is that we're at very tight load resource balance today. And so we need to invest, we think, in new natural gas capacity to serve load reliably. We think in the long run, we'll still need that capacity all the way out through 2050 potentially. So that's not a bad investment. It's not going to become a stranded asset. We need that capability to serve load reliably now, and we'll continue to need it in the future. So I think I went maybe a little bit over, so hopefully there's still a little bit of time for questions.
Just a little overwhelmed. Just trying to, you know, put all of this together, and I'm not looking to be supportive or critical of the New Deal Green that's being proposed. And that's a 10-year program, and this is 30. I'm just trying to distill all of that and find categories and places for it to fit. And so if I don't have any further questions right now, it's just because I'm bewildered and trying to get a handle on it. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the presentation. And, Steve, thanks for the invitation to have the presentation to us. For us for consideration and trying to figure out where our part is and what our part may be. Thank you.
Let me take a second. I'd like, if I could, just offer a couple of comments on this and try to bring this home as to what it means for Chelan too. So first of all, it's been great to have E3 as a partner because they have a lot of credibility in the West. And so we're able to bring someone to the table who you can see the vast knowledge that Arnie and his team have about how the electric power system in the West operates. And so he just is able to describe things in ways that many other people cannot, and with the depth of analysis that goes with this. This 10-page presentation you've got is backed up by 200 pages of presentation that we got and 10,000 pages of documentation. So there's a lot of stuff behind this that explains in depth how this works. Second, just want to emphasize that we have dreamed about at times trying to think about this from an all-sector perspective, but all of this work is electric sector only. It's focused on how do you get to deep decarbonization in the electric sector. And on the basis that there is hope that if you're going to do deep decarbonization across the economy, that it will require electrification of vehicle fleets and buildings and a variety of different things. And if you're going to be successful at that, then you better have a low-cost, reliable electric system or people aren't going to be willing to make the substitution. So we should be seeking, first of all, to accomplish the goals in the electric sector, but at least cost and maintaining reliability in order to meet these bigger goals that folks have. Third point, we do feel like this has made a difference in Olympia. If you go back to the chart that Arnie showed that described no new natural gas, renewable portfolio standard, and the price on carbon. This was the debate in the last legislature. Now, I'm not going to say that this was the only thing that changed that debate, but we do think it was significant in terms of the discussion because it displayed what the choice is for the state. If your goal really is about carbon emission reductions, it seems like we should all align around trying to create a healthy economy and a healthy environment, and that you do that by choosing least cost paths to get there. And we feel like that message we were successful in being able to deliver. And I would also note that if you go to the slide that you added there where the hockey stick slide, when we met with the folks from the Senate Energy Committee earlier this year when they came to Wenatchee, they actually told us that they understood the hockey stick and that they understood that was something that needed to be thought about and addressed in terms of the policies they developed. So we feel like our messages are getting through. Now, let me turn for a second into specific implications for us, things that we've learned that are useful to Chelan beyond just the general policy issues. First of all, I would just say, take a look at the number of solar and wind additions, even in the case that is the least cost case. They are huge. And some of that stuff is going to show up around here. We're already starting to see some of that. So it just opens our eyes to the fact that if this is likely to be the policy of the state going forward, whatever it might be, 50%, 80%, pick the number, you're still going to have a lot of renewable additions. And there's likely to be some of them that are going to show up in our neighborhood, and that has implications for us in terms of how we will manage and operate our system. Second, the capacity price problem that Commissioner Bowles referenced is a capacity price problem for hydro as well. So the value of hydro is not adequately compensated in the markets today. And that problem of how do you make sure that you get adequate compensation for the least cost resources to meet reliability targets is a focal point for us in terms of trying to address future policies. Third, those cases where you have large curtailments that are taking place, Arnie described those as occurring in the wind and solar regime. I would just say that there will be a debate as to whether that happens for wind and solar or for hydro. We will all be zero variable energy cost resources seeking market share at those moments. And the fact of the matter is that how that gets determined will probably be a public policy matter as well as an economic matter. And we've seen how that's played out in the past with some of the debates that have occurred at the FERC. And it doesn't always play out that the newest resource is the one that gets curtailed. It can just as easily be the one that's already existing. So that there are some real challenges there potentially for us as well. And one of the reasons why we would say not only is it bad public policy to choose a very expensive, low reliability option, but it also is displacing a least cost option that you have available because it's already built and operating. Final point I'd make is just that in the last 6 months, we've seen in the market price excursions, which tend to, I wouldn't say absolutely confirm, but at least give us some suspicions that this analysis is correct. So we saw price excursions last summer, very high prices on the shoulder hours, which is consistent with what we would have anticipated because you've got a lot of wind and solar. It's not available during the shoulder hours, so the prices go up a lot. We saw $300 prices last summer, which are extraordinary prices. We also saw very high prices in December when you had the pipeline explosion in Vancouver. and we've seen very high prices the last 2 weeks when the temperatures have been very cold. So we've had extended cold temperatures, Alberta, British Columbia, the Pacific Northwest. And we've seen $100 to $150 prices, actually probably more in the $75 range today. But we are beginning to see some evidence that the types of things that Arnie and his team have been talking about, that those will be realities come a number of years in the future. We see harbingers of that in the marketplace today. So there's enough there to say it looks like this stuff is real, and policymakers should be aware of this kind of work as they think about the types of issues that they are considering in Olympia today and in Washington, D.C., and in Sacramento, basically all around us.
So a question I have is on the cost models. Is that inclusive of transmission costs, or are transmission costs not calculated in those numbers that you shared?
You know, we've included some costs, some dollars to represent the new transmission you might need.
Okay.
Not an exhaustive analysis of that, but I think the bigger question about transmission is less the dollars, just can you find a corridor?
Correct.
You know, yeah.
But if you could find the corridor.
Yeah.
For the most part, what you shared in terms of cost is inclusive of transmission.
Yes.
That's helpful.
Is that cost also inclusive or takes into consideration going forward, continued subsidies for the new renewables, solar and wind?
No, and we've assumed here that the federal subsidies roll off on the current schedule. So by 2023, all the federal subsidies will be gone. So this includes most of the renewables built here are unsubsidized from the, at least from the federal level.
I have a question that really sure how to phrase, but if we go back and take a look at our overbuild of renewables and you carry out into the future beyond 2025 or 2050, what the impact of overbuilding is on organizations such as ours and others, in so much that the wholesale market now makes energy pricing so low that businesses and entities such as ours can't survive. We can't continue to pay our overhead cost and compete with that overbuild of solar and wind. So if you carry that scenario forward, have you looked at that at all, at what impact that does to the grid?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't played out the scenarios where these things cause retirement of existing resources, let's say. But certainly, if this was caused by subsidies that were targeting one type of resource and leaving another one behind, then absolutely, you know, the policies are designed as if the hydro and the nuclear that we have today will be there forever. Right? We only want to focus on what's new because we already have the hydro. And that may be true in the short term, but in the long term, all these resources need continued reinvestment for them to be viable. So certainly, if there's a policy that doesn't focus on that, then it's going to make each one of those decisions increasingly difficult. And at some point, you probably stop making those investments and you put your money into wind and solar because that's where the subsidies would drive you. And that doesn't leave you in a good direction in terms of the services that the grid needs to be reliable.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, I want to thank Arnie for being here. It's been really great to have you. I'm a little bit worried about he's got a plane to catch, and I want to get him moving towards that so he doesn't miss out on the opportunity to be at another meeting tomorrow that is going to help us as we debate resource adequacy standards in the Northwest, whether they should be established, which helps us because we believe that it will lead to the development of capacity and better capacity pricing than what we see in the market today.
Well, I want to thank you again for the opportunity. And I'm sorry if I left you bewildered. I was hoping to do the opposite.
No, but good job for Wildcat. That's all I'm doing.
I do want to point out that all my contact information is here. So if you do have follow-up questions, yeah. I don't know if Steve would prefer you to go through him or not.
No.
You're welcome to reach out to me. I'm happy to answer any questions by email, by phone. Next time I'm in Wenatchee, you name it.
I do appreciate you being here. Yeah. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you again.
Thank you, Arnie.
Okay, so we're going to turn from that to something a lot more local. So I'm going to invite Dan Frazier to come up and talk about, we are now at the point, after I believe more than 3 years of study, we are ready to have a discussion about our outreach plan for a discussion of a service center headquarters consolidation of facilities. So, Dan?
Thank you, Steve. Morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. And today I'd like to take you through a quick presentation. I say quick. I know it's long, but we'll try to be quick about it. Our goal here today is, actually we have two goals. One, to provide an update of where we are in the process, the ongoing work that's been going on, particularly in finalizing our business case, the financial modeling, what's had been happening in pre-design, and unveiling our conceptual plans, first generation of that today. And then to talk a little bit about the public outreach, we're going to start our formal public outreach process. As you know, we've been engaged with a customer advisory group for some time, but we will be making a more concerted formal effort with our public outreach and employee outreach. As you recall, as we went through this process, and Steve, 3 years is right. I've been here 3 years, and I've been involved the whole time. And we talked about five strategic core goals that we were focusing on. And what we've done is distilled those down into three, because really three of those goals were all financial. So the financial goals have been wrapped up into just provide the best financial value to our customer owners. That really comes down to what's our main goal here. Then to provide the best customer service, both visiting us and us visiting our customers, and of course, to enhance safety. And so we want to tie back to our strategic plan and the fact this is an asset management effort that we've been working on for several years throughout the district, but we wanted to remind everybody of those three core goals what we're trying to achieve through this process. So the customer service benefit, this is one you know, when I saw this, I wasn't surprised, but I'd never seen it in these terms before. This is the location of our meters, and using the hub of Old Station as the transportation hub of the three spokes that come down the river, down the valley, and then back into Wenatchee. Those are our meter counts. And so from that point, about 60% of our meters are north and west of that central point. And so this location that we've are looking at and we've selected, it really is the best place for us to locate in terms of providing that customer service. If you look at what we did analysis around the actual truck rolls or the amount of work our crews are doing, that number jumps above 60 to closer to 70% because the growth has been occurring in the Chelan and the upper valley areas and not as much in the Wenatchee area. So really we are moving much more centralized. We would be moving much more centralized to our customer service goals. This is just a great illustration of what facilities that are purpose-built can give you. Our current conditions, we have trucks out in the snow, we have transformers out in the snow, and I'm not sure which facility I'd like to go to at 2 in the morning when my power is out, but I think the one on the right is the one our customers would like to see us rolling out of. A big portion of the benefits of a consolidated facility have to do with travel and productivity. Well, travel costs, we did spend quite a bit of time on this, and the numbers we were using were 2014 and 2015. We did the travel analysis in 2016, and that's what revealed that 70% of service trips are north of the current headquarters. So we monetized that cost of our crews sitting on North Wenatchee Avenue. Our crews going back and forth to different facilities to pick up their vehicles, their equipment, their materials. We also analyzed the cost of people coming in from our other areas, the Holly Street and the CTC, coming to headquarters for meetings. And that cost was pegged at around $750,000 per year. It's a lot to, as I say, waste on North Wenatchee Avenue. Question came up the other day, did you update this analysis to take into account North Wenatchee continues to get worse every year? And no, we didn't, because it was a conservative estimate at the time. It probably just became more conservative because it continues to decline. The levels of service of the traffic on North Wenatchee Avenue continue to get worse. So it just makes the business case stronger as time goes on. In a previous life, when I was with the city of Wenatchee and involved in the transportation modeling, this is the growth factor and the delays on North Wenatchee Avenue continue to mount. Even after a Confluence Parkway is built, they'll reset for a bit and then just get worse again. So this isn't a problem that's going away. So on the refresh of the economic analysis, this is the slide we've been using all along to compare our costs and some of our qualitative and quantitative pieces. The 50-year present cost is how we make our decisions at the district here. It's a 50-year net present cost. So it's all the costs and the productivity and O&M savings all dialed back to 2019 dollars. And as you can see, there's a wide spread all the way from the redevelopment in place, which we called Scenario 2, to the consolidated, and there's quite a spread between those options. A couple other things that have come up, and if you see the greater than or equal to sign in this in most of those numbers, it's because as we went through the process of validating our assumptions, as we said, this process that we've done in the last year and a half is validating our assumptions and finding more information. What we found is that there are cost increases associated with those scenarios that we didn't go back and revisit in great detail because they just made those scenarios more and actually made them worse. The costs associated with something like adding a substation at Holly Street, reducing the land area there. So can we even build what we were planning on building in a Holly Street redevelopment? Confluence Parkway has gotten some more legs behind it. The city and the North Central Transportation group are really pushing that Confluence Parkway. Has an impact on our Holly Street property, and so would we even want to rebuild in that location, knowing that there's a good chance that someday in the future that project's going to make an impact to our facility there. So the greater than or equal to is really just a way to account for some of the additional costs that have come in that just make those a little less palatable solutions. If you go through the other options, there are the other qualitative pieces, the maximized productivity. Those are really just ranges. There's some things that do a great job at maximizing productivity. There's some that do a pretty good job. If you notice the permanent split, our crews would be dispatched out of a much better location, but the interface with the management administration isn't there, so you have a little bit less of a productivity. Cost predictability, any new facility is going to help you there, but not necessarily to the degree that an all-new campus would provide. And then that qualitative evaluation, there's a lot of pieces that fell into that category, all the way from working with a group that you are co-located with versus having to go across town, the ability to provide safety. And one of the things I'll touch on here is the consolidated site gives us the best flexibility and resilience as we move forward in the next 50 years of the PUD. Any questions on this slide before I head off? Okay. So this one does a great job explaining kind of the payback. I know it's a little confusing in the first several years. You've got a lot of competing scenarios there, but it starts to distinguish the benefits as you move through time. About 2035 is that crossover event. So the dashed line would be the status quo that we've built around, trying to maintain our existing facilities. The blue line is the consolidation. And the two other scenarios do well for a period of time, but eventually you do see some separation between the benefits of those versus the consolidation. Those little steps, what we did in this process, if you have a 50-year spreadsheet, you can imagine what that looks like on a piece of paper. So we did 5-year roll-ups. So the reason those steps are there is because you're making 5-year investments. They just kind of show up in those steps. But they are predictable, that you will have to do O&M and system maintenance and system replacement. And so this was really well done. What we did in this, between the last slide and this slide, is in updating the analysis, we went back to those scenarios that fell out of consideration early on and brought them current so that we could look at all five of these scenarios in terms of did we do enough analysis? Do we have enough information to answer the question? And we brought in our great analysts here. Micah Linderman did a really nice deep dive back into the numbers, making sure that we had everything we needed to make a good decision. Very thoughtful, because he took us all back down memory lane. We had to remember why we did certain things, but we were able to get him the information he needed to refresh this and provide good confidence in that these are the right numbers that we're presenting. If you recall, the board has provided a $50 million directed fund for facilities. So that is something we want to make sure the public understands. One of the things Micah did was stress test. Sensitivity test this model. And what are the things we worry about? Well, construction cost is always something we worry about. So how much could construction cost vary, and this is still the right solution? How about our productivity and travel savings? Did we overestimate that? As someone who worked on it, I'd say we were pretty conservative with that, but say we were only able to obtain 25% of that productivity and travel savings, it would still pencil out because the savings was pretty significant. So they could be reduced by up to 75%, and it would still pencil out. And the reason is the operation and maintenance cost is another big component of the cost savings. And the discount rate, we use 7% here at the district, so we did all our modeling with 7%. Well, it gets to 9.8 before it becomes ambiguous, so it's a really good return. We didn't do an IRR calculation. Sometimes you see those on our hydro project business cases, but to get to 10%, that's a pretty extreme case before the analysis would change. And so through all of those, if we applied those sensitivities to the model, the ranking did not change. The relative ranking between those options did not change. So what's our takeaway of this analysis? The takeaway is a couple things, qualitatively and quantitatively. Qualitatively, the dollars and cents, travel savings and productivity, optimize one location. You'll always be able to beat a split facility because you'll always have a travel component that you can't equalize in the model. System replacements and maintenance. Anytime you build a new facility, you are getting a new kind of a new start. We talked about if you take a car and you put a new engine and transmission in it, you've gone a long ways, but it's still a 20-year-old chassis you're dealing with. And that's one of the things that getting a new facility, you start that clock over again. And then plus economies of scale. Building in one location, a consolidated location, is going to give you a better economy of scale than building on multiple sites over years and years. Qualitatively, we know that the site that we have out in Old Station that we're very close to securing it gives us great resilience and adaptability. It's got the best transportation linkages. It has room for a little bit of expansion and even potential for more expansion. We do have an option on one of the neighboring properties. residual value. That's one of the things we did not put into the model, because it's hard to predict 50 years out what the value of that of those buildings are, but we know it's there. We have a building, like this building's over 50 years now. It has some value here, but in 100 years, how much value will it have? The tech shop is 100 years old already, and it doesn't have a lot of value left, but we didn't put that in the model. Maybe we want to pollute the model with some estimates way out, but we know it's there. And finally, that co-location element. It's you can't put that in the model, but you know there is a benefit to having people that are out in the field working on the crews, having their supervisors close by, having their support system close by. And actually, that kind of leads us into this, what we're calling the tail versus the dog. There's a lot of question as to what's driving a consolidated facility. And really, it's about getting the customer, those people serving our customers in the right location with all their equipment and vehicles and materials, and the line crews, the fiber crews, the water wastewater crews, all them closer to what to the work they do, and with their support system. So the tail in this case is the support system. It's the supervisors. It's the warehouse. It's the legal team. It's procurement and contract services, all the way up to and including the senior team and the general manager, all support that really core team that needs to be in the right location. And so we know that co-location serves a great benefit, and this is just kind of a graphical representation of what we're trying to explain as to why a consolidation works and what the drivers are for a consolidation.
Dan, can I just interrupt for just a second?
You bet.
I think it's really important for me anyway to be able to listen to this and assure our owners that we've continued to go back and look at the data, answer the questions as you've rolled this out, and can just continue to hammer on that evaluation and realize that no matter how we look at this, that the direction that we're going makes the best fiscal sense. That just really has hit me today, and I appreciate Micah's deep dive, the work that's gone on there, your work, and I think it's really important for us. So I just want to make that point that
we'll make sure to highlight that.
This is really, I think just to reinforce that we've continued not only to listen, but to really go back and answer those questions and keep looking. As every question's come up, we keep looking, and we're not afraid of those questions, and we're going to let the numbers dictate the direction that we're going here. So anyway, I just appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's something that, you know, it's the cornerstone of the business case is that financial model. I think everything else that we considered in the qualitative side, you don't really look at, don't spend too much time on that until it makes quantitative sense, mm-hmm. And that's where the numbers had to be there before we went down into these other issues that are all benefits. Okay, so a couple of things I did mention already, Holly Street, things that are affecting the scenario selection. Holly Street continues to be more of a challenge. The city of Wenatchee has a kind of redevelopment plan for that area. Our Holly Street Operations Center doesn't really fit with that, and so there's additional impacts and outside influences on that site that make the stay at Holly Street in some capacity much more difficult to do. There's been also an increased physical security requirements related to the FERC's on our standards on our critical operations that we know we would have to make an investment sometime in the next 5 to 10 years, and it just makes sense to do that with this facility. Again, the updated financial analysis provides that this is the best cost over a 50-year period. And then something we've been working on, one of the biggest concerns we heard was concerning the downtown, the impact on downtown that the PUD potential exit would make. And what we wanted to do was be able to show the community that there is a life after the PUD on this site, and we're already started the process. We're working with the port and the city. We've engaged the Wenatchee Downtown Association, the Chamber of Commerce. They're active on the team that's looking at redevelopment. We've had a couple meetings so far, and really good opportunities, I think, are going to come out of this. And the engagement in the public will be really important in this in the business community. So I'll touch on that just a bit later. So how would we do this? So the big reveal. This is the plans that you've been seeing for a long time. The public has seen a kind of a site plan on the left. This is administration and crew building is the blue building. The orange and yellow buildings are all related to operational functions, line crews, transformer shop, water wastewater shop, fleet shop, all those shops in the back. And then the green buildings are more of storage, building for storage of vehicles and equipment or storage of materials like the transformers and cross arms, all the hardware, those kind of things. The site flow on the right works kind of like a city. It's alleys and streets. It's good circulation and allows things to happen throughout the site throughout the day without kind of bottlenecking anything. So architects get to talk about design inspiration. Those of us on the technical side, we kind of just build something, but we want it to look good. So as we've talked about this process, what is Chelan County? Chelan County is a great example of a lot of different things. We have rivers, we have orchards, we have the mountains. We have agriculture in both orchards and vineyards. We have all kinds of different outdoor activities. We have recreation. So trying to bring those things into the design of the facility was very important. So this is an aerial drone shot, as we call it, of a concept of the campus. It shows the administration building in the foreground there, the operations in the back, and it really kind of gives you the idea how big this facility is and how much of it is dedicated to the operations. We have this is actually a little bit smaller. If you took all of our properties right now and all where we're spread out, this is a little smaller of a footprint because they're going to be more efficient. It does give us a little room for expansion. If you see, there's quite a bit of room between the buildings and some room off to the south of those buildings. So it's really kind of that full campus look, and you can see some of the buildings are like open canopies. Some of them are enclosed buildings. But it kind of speaks to the type of architecture we're thinking of in terms of durable. This is a 50-year facility at a minimum. I don't like to actually think. I like to think of this as a 100-year facility because these buildings with the materials we're talking about should last that long. Here's some other shots inside the facility looking north. So you got the line dock on the left. You got crew building, actually shop buildings on the right. You see the materials are more durable materials. These look like tilt-up concrete panels with form liners to make them look like brick. Those type of things, the materials have not been chosen yet. We're just trying to present what the overall look would be. This is the idea of an entry plaza. That's a model of the Columbia River from the Canadian border down to the Pacific in terms of those are each of the dams. Each one of those steps would be a dam on the Columbia system. But we wanted to have an inviting place where people come in and can see their PUD a little better than stepping out of your car right into our lobby on North Wenatchee Avenue as it is now.
And Dan, can you cover the safety feature, why it's located where it is? And
sure, you bet. So when we started talking about what a plaza would be and the proximity of the roads, we do want to provide security for our building in terms of not having somebody driving right into our lobby. So those you see the benches and the water feature, both are physical barriers that would separate a vehicle from the building and being able to approach the building. Now, this is a concept of the lobby. Again, this is something that we want to engage the public on. What would you like your Chelan PUD lobby to look like? But something like this, the idea of a two-story lobby allows us to bring more customer service functions into the lobby without this really massive kind of, you know, a lobby all on one floor where you try to fit all those things. So upstairs would be new meters and those kind of services. Downstairs, pay your bill, conservation. But we do want to engage the public as we move through schematic design, which if we go forward, that's the next step would be schematic design, to see what does Chelan want to see in their lobby, in the lobby? What does Cashmere want to see in the lobby? So that's something we would be working on as we move forward. Here's just a little piece on energy efficiency. It's a nice, interesting what drives your design. And we did a daylighting study. We wanted to provide as much daylight as possible, but we also don't want glare on people's work, so we did this daylighting study. And one of the things that came out is maybe we need to have some exterior shading that can be architectural in nature. You picked this up on one of the other renderings, but these are the type of things that we'll do through more of schematic design and design development. But just to let you know, we are thinking a lot about conservation. We're trying to make this building as high a conservation as can be achieved. This is our milestone schedule. Today we're in that February, that middle bar of the top section, the public outreach. We kicked that off today. We plan on coming back in April with the information from the public outreach. But if we do move forward and we were to do the hatch schedule and then the execution down below, we'd be moving in sometime mid to late 2022. So here's our public outreach plan schedule. So we did meet with our Citizen Advisory Committee, our Customer Advisory Group, about a month ago. We have today's board presentation. I'm actually going to leave here and run to the port and give a presentation to the port commissioners. We've got radio, TV, social media, websites all set up. Lots of information on our website. We'll give information and ability for feedback for our customers. Then we'll be at service clubs, civic groups, port, community councils throughout March, and then culminating in a series of 5 open houses in toward the end of March. And our goal is to bring that all the feedback we receive back to the board on April 1st. One thing that we did receive some feedback from our customer advisory group, and they didn't see the renderings you saw today, but they did look at our overall outreach plan, and one of the things they said is, remember, this is the entry to the city of Wenatchee, so you need to balance the cost and the aesthetics. We want this to be a nice entry into the city, and they like the opportunity for all Chelan County communities to participate in the design. There were some questions about, we were still in the analysis phase, and so there's some questions about the consolidations versus the split campuses, campus scenarios, and so we're providing that information back to them. And then we want to focus on the timing and the effects of any decision. And finally, the redevelopment planning. They like the idea of working with the downtown, but they also said if you can, do an early victory. Find a piece that you could turn over to a developer early and try to get something started on this site before the PUD leaves. So that's definitely something we're looking at. Finally, we did go to Olympia a couple weeks ago and got unanimous approval from the State Project Review Committee. They are very impressed with Chelan PUD. They actually pulled me aside after the meeting and said, we're really, really happy that Chelan PUD has chosen 2 GCCM projects and a design build project, the Powerhouse 2 project. They see that we're the only PUD, Grant actually has one project, but the only PUD that's really embracing this, and they see us as they'd like to see us get what's called agency approval so that we could do this with any project that we wanted to do without having to go to the state every time.
Wow.
So they're very impressed by the work that we've been doing on this. And so we started that GCCM procurement process. It's a 4-to-5-month process. We'll be back to really kick that off next meeting, March 4th. Board meeting, we asked the board to allow us to get out to the contractors with requests for qualifications, and I've actually heard from several contractors interested in this project. So, and then we will be back in June for actually entering into that contract with the GCCM. So that's it. We went a little long again. The results, the ongoing work were good. The financial modeling did come back strong, so we've provided our concept for going out to the public and coming back to the commission in a few months. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice presentation.
Yep.
Yeah. Good presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah. If I could add just a couple of quick things. First of all, I really want to thank Micah. I think he's done a great job, but we kind of pulled him in a little late in this process, to be honest. Probably should have thought of it earlier and then said, we need for you to go, and we need for you to go fast. And he did. He really did a very thorough job, and it was very helpful to us. And I think particularly the insight about looking at various scenarios and that the order doesn't change in terms of the scenarios. When you consider things like discount rate and cost of project, that was a valuable insight to get out of this. We're grateful to him for his work. And if you would, Dan, would you go back to this slide here for a moment, please. So we are headed towards, we think, making a decision. We've been at this for more than 3 years in terms of study. And from staff's perspective, at least, I would say, go back one more. We would say we need to pick one of these paths. And the you know, the choices here. Basically, the consolidated path wins, you would say, in every case except that you have to spend more money up front. So the $81 million versus the $143 million is the near-term cost associated with this. But it turns out, and this is completely fortuitous, it has nothing to do with the way the analysis was done. The board put away $50 million, which happens to be the difference between the initial capital and the consolidated case. Why the $50 million? Well, it had to do with how much we ended up above budget in 2016 and 2017. It wasn't related to this particular analysis. We didn't know these numbers were going to turn out this way. But we are in a position at this point with money set aside to be able to, in effect, neutralize even that difference. And so from our perspective, it hopefully looks like a clear choice. But we will wait to see what the public has to say. And what you have now seen is what you will, Dan and others, will be presenting in public meetings, city councils, civic clubs over the course of the next 6 weeks.
Somehow Arsenal knew the numbers. I don't know.
Right.
Pure luck.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's better to be lucky.
We'll take it.
So, Dan, recognizing in this area how organizations such as ours and school districts build facilities for 50 years, I think there's got to be a clear recognition. This building is 70 to 80 years old. Cashmere High School, I was on the school board when that was built. You know, we designed it for...
That's about 90 years.
Yeah. we designed that for a 50-year life, or that was the expectation. It's now 40 years old, and it's just been in the middle of a current major upgrade. It's going to be there for another 40 or 50 years. So, you know, us talking about a 50-year replacement cost, it's going to be a 70 or an 80 or longer. It really is. So that's what we're building here. It's something for the really long term.
We did have to put bookends on the modeling because people start to get less and less sure. but I appreciate the comment because I think there is such a residual value to the buildings, especially if they're purpose built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm finally not hearing in the community that the new Wenatchee High School, because it is somewhere between 43 and 45 years old. You know, and so I think it's a good analogy in terms of how that facility has served this particular community and how Cashmere schools have served that community. And when you build for 50 years or more, it, across the board, it's a great attribute for the city and turns out to be a benefit, not an expense.
So, okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Good job.
I'd like to invite Stacy Jagla up to give the annual audit committee report.
Stacy Jagla, internal audit manager. I know we've got a couple more presentations, so I'm going to try to even condense even more so, since you're all familiar with the 2018 audit committee annual report. Our two serving commissioners for 2018 were Commissioner Bowles and Commissioner Arsenault. As you read through the report, hopefully you were able to kind of glean the themes of the audit committee out of there, and in essence of time, I won't repeat those. But I wanted to highlight a few things for the year for the audit committee I thought worked really well. We had on page 2 in our March meeting a report from PricewaterhouseCoopers for our 2017 financial statement audit, a clean audit from PricewaterhouseCoopers, as always. Page 4 in November, and then in January 2019, we had the State Auditor's Office come. And if you recall, I think at an earlier board meeting through the manager's item, I did talk about the State Auditor's 2017 accountability audit. We did had a really good results out of that. They came in January to present the compliance for the Energy Independence Act, which was I-937. For both our conservation target and our renewable energy targets. And of course, we had great results on that audit as well. And lastly, I just wanted to highlight on page 5 of the report, kind of the last large paragraph there. Internal audit had our first external quality assessment. That's the who audits the auditor. Then I had a review of our department to assess our conformance with professional standards and also to evaluate the effectiveness of how we're performing assurance and consulting for the audit committee and management. And we had an on-site team here for a week, and they concluded that our rating was generally conforms, which is the top rating for the for complying with the standards and the code of ethics and our work. So I just wanted to share that. It was standards require that we have that review, so you'll be seeing that. We'll have one every 5 years. I'll have another team come on and take a look at our department to make sure that our work is in accordance with standards and meeting management's expectations. So those were kind of the highlights for the year. Were there any questions?
It was a very good review. And you know, I don't get excited about sitting through audit meetings, but it's really it's really gratifying to understand the clarity in which we operate and the transparency in which we operate, and to have that validated through the state audit.
Yep.
And appreciation, Stacy, to you and the staff that work so hard to ensure the fact that the public is being served well, transparently, and with absolute clarity. Yep. So thank you again very, very much.
You're welcome.
We're going to change that outlook, too. You're going to be excited about audit committee.
I know. But you notice I'm saying that as I'm stepping off.
I did know that.
Yeah. And for 2019, this year we'll have Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner McKenna on the audit committee this year.
The board part just got better. Yeah.
I'd like to just echo Commissioner Bolt's comments on the audit committee. It's really a delight to be able to sit and listen to the in-depth dive that audit committee does and provides for the district. But what I find even more delightful, really, is the fact that as the state comes in and reviews your audit findings, they couldn't be more happy with the work that you're mm-hmm. doing. Mm-hmm. So that's a trick in and of itself, is to get the state to get on board and agree with what your audit findings are. And you guys seem to do it, make it look easy, and I know it's not easy. I know it's really hard. It's a good job for you and your team.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It can be a challenge at times.
Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
But you guys answer the challenge and do it well. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks, Stacy.
Guys being a generic term.
Mm-hmm. Next up, I want to invite Mark Mullins and Craig Coons. So end of year financial review, a big deal. And, give them a chance to describe what a terrific year it's been.
So do we need to discuss how many pages this is before I put my foot in my mouth again? I just don't want Kelly back there with anticipation.
Thank you, Steve. Mark Mullins, Director of Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And to my right is?
Craig Coons, Manager of Strategic Financial Planning.
So I know we're a little pressed on time. We'll try to move through this relatively quickly, but we're to report our quarterly financial review for period ending December 31st, 2018. So this presentation does serve to meet compliance with some of our long-range policies for the board, financial policies, business line financial policies, and our investment policy, as well as our board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship. So I think you'll find the results similar to Q3. Maybe a little bit better, so we'll go through this relatively quickly. There is some additional information in the back in the appendix. We won't cover that today, but what we will cover, and this information, of course, is pending annual audit, but we'll go through our financial highlights, look at our year-end results, a historical review, and then a five-year look forward. We'll take a brief look at our investment report and then give the board a heads up on some of our debt actions associated for 2019. This is an update only, no action required. So our key highlights, our bottom line results are better than budget. We ended the year at $105.3 million, $32.5 million better than budget. Our combined district metrics are meeting their targets. Our recommendation is to stay the course with our strategic goals, which are reinvesting in assets and people, reduce debt, and continue with the public power benefit. So quick overview on the income statement side. From a revenue perspective, we are slightly under budget. From a service revenue perspective, the December temperatures were fairly mild. Net wholesale revenue was slightly below budget for the year. We did have a Lake Chelan outage that was not in the budget that is contributing to that, although there are a lot of moving parts to that number. We have our hydro long-term contract revenue, $17.1 million better than budget, primarily due to the district retaining some of the surplus sales proceeds. And other operating revenue, where we benefited from a FEMA cost recovery early in the year. And then we have the variable piece of our real-time agreement that we benefited from. So overall, $20 million better than budget from a revenue perspective. On the expense side, $10.4 million less than budget on the expenses, primarily due to a $6 million actuarial reduction in pension expense. That was a bottom-line benefit. On the non-operating net expense, that's better in budget by $2.8 million. We have higher cash balances, and we're also benefiting from some higher interest rates as well. So net expenses, better than budget by $13 million for the year. You combine those two, higher revenues and lower expenses, and you have a bottom line that exceeded our budget by $32.5 million. Quick look at capital. We had a budget in 2018 of $141 million. Our actual expenditures were 89, so we did come in short at 63% of the budget. The major drivers were primarily Rock Island, where $42 million of the $52 million that we fell short of was really due to some deferred work, meaning the schedules have changed for out into 2019 and 2020 for Rock Island B1 through B4. B7 modernization, and also the Rock Island facilities. On the cash side, we ended the year at $591.3 million, $80 million than where we started the year. This is all attributable to the positive bottom line, our lower capital spend, and also the Alcoa contractual payments that we received. On the debt side, we landed right in line with what we were expecting from a budget perspective at $513.5 million. You will note our cash balance at 591 is exceeding our debt outstanding at 513, which is a good story. So I'll turn it over to Craig, and he can get into some of the details.
Yeah, and I'm just going to, since Mark talked about the main drivers, I'm just going to compare pretty much what we were saying at Q3 versus where we're at in year end. And there's primarily three drivers that are going to influence the results. That's we had additional about $5 million of retained surplus proceeds from our long-term power contract and what we had at Q3, so that was an improvement of about $5 million in revenue. That actuarial pension expense was about a $6 million reduction of expenses. It's a non-cash item, but it is a reduction of expenses, and the item I would note is we're not in control of that. I mean, that's an actuarial adjustment we get from the state. That could be an additional expense in the future. It could be a negative, reduction. Just happened to be a $6 million benefit. And we also had improved interest earnings, which Mark talked about. So we look at our financial highlights here in regards to our electric delivered cost per average kWh. The drivers here are pretty much our power production costs. That's driven by two main things. One, we're slightly below budget. You can see that below in the hydro production cost per unit. Part of that's attributed to the pension expense adjustment that flowed through. And in addition, we had slightly lower than budgeted generation, but you take those both in consideration, it actually was a net a lower production cost, about 2.45 versus a plan of 2.50. Looking at our power distribution costs, again, a primary driver of that reduction in that cost is the pension expense flow through. Looking at some of the other metrics, water cost per gallon, operating costs were about 96% of budget, resulted in a better than budget expectation there, but pretty close. Wastewater was about 83% of budget. Primary driver here is a deferral of $120,000 Lake Wenatchee lab project. The reason I'm calling that out is that's a significant cost for the wastewater system, which is going to show up in 2019. So that might have an impact on will have an impact on their 2019 operating metrics, moving that big of a cost. And fiber costs were pretty much right in line with budget, to be honest with you, except for the pension adjustment have a pretty significant impact to that year-to-date operating expenses being at 86%. So looking at our bottom line results, I'm just going to really highlight the Q3 changes. Again, service revenue was down a little bit from Q3, and that's due to the mild temperatures of December. Again, the hydro long-term contract revenue is up quite a bit. That, again, is the surplus proceeds from the long-term contract. And our non-operating expenses are quite a bit better. It's a net expense. It's better due to the interest earnings. Looking at our bottom line business results, looking at kind of the integrated electric, again, the cost-based activity, that is attributed to the surplus proceeds retained. Other activities is better due to interest earnings. And all the fiber, water, and wastewater are all showing improvements from Q3, and that is basically the ripple through of that pension expense as it gets allocated to the individual systems, that actuarial adjustment, non-cash item. So when we look at our capital expenditures, the ones I would highlight again, Mark talked on this. This is Rock Island. Again, the primary drivers are the B1 through 4, B7, and the Rock Island upgrade work. Other than that, I would note that network transmission, that's tied to some work around, since it's at 56% of budget, that's tied around to the Mid-Sea Capital Project. It's about a $500 million deferral to 2019. And the Greater McNeil Canyon, another $500,000 project. Or difference that got rolled into 2019. Looking at our overall the cash flow, we start with our bottom line of 105. We add back one particular non-cash item that's significant, which is depreciation, which gives us an estimated earned funds from operations of 149 million. We took that 149 million, we spent 89 million on capital projects. We spent another 24 million to reduce our debt. We also use another $18 million to basically pay for, most part, accounts payable at year-end, you know, the difference between what we had, and some miscellaneous other items. But we also received $62 million from Alcoa for the shutdown settlement. And we take all that in consideration. We added $80 million to our cash reserve, taking all that activity together. So we started the year at $511 million. We added $80 million, and now at year-end 2018, we're at $591 million. This is just simply a breakdown in regards to our cash and investments at year-end compared to year-end 2017. You can see the improvement from 511 to 591. And again, I would just highlight that, we, as was mentioned by Steve earlier, the $50 million that we have in reserve for the headquarters and service center strategic facilities fund. This is a quick slide. We've shown this in the past. I've condensed the years to really focus on 2013 through 2018. This kind of puts more things in perspective, since when our long-term power contracts were renewed in the 2012 timeframe, this kind of puts everything on the same playing field. And it just graphically shows our increase of expenditures, which we've been talking about for some time. So we're basically at 146 in 2013, and we're looking at, I can't do the math in my head, it's 253 in 2018. So that's a $107 million increase over that time period, which is basically a 73% increase over that time period, just to put in context with all the work we're doing with all the capital improvements and everything. And this is just looking at, and even considering all that, this is taking a snapshot of our cash to our debt balance in that same time frame. So basically, our debt was in excess of our cash of about $395 million in 2013. And now our cash is actually $77 million ahead of our debt balance. That's a swing of about $472 million to the good. So we've taken all of our successful years, and we've increased our cash reserves, and we've paid down debt substantially. So even with those increased costs.
That's a very telling graphic.
Yeah.
And much appreciated.
You bet.
I like that chart.
I do.
So moving into our quarterly reporting requirements, this is our district's financial policies. This is very consistent to Q3. Again, nothing significantly has changed. Again, we are forecasting to be in the market, external market, in 2022 to maintain liquidity based on our current capital forecast. And those are highlighted in yellow, just because it's within 10% of our target. Still meeting the target, but our policy says we'll mention to the board when we're within 10%. Nothing significantly has changed. Looking at our business line metrics, pretty consistent with Q3 reporting. Here's water, wastewater. And again, wastewater, you can see this dip in 2019 down to 86%. That's what I alluded to earlier when we shifted that $120,000 project to 2019. It had a pretty big impact to 2019. And it bounces back up to 2020 and 2021. So I just wanted to have that out there for that impact. And again, fiber is consistent, looks really great, all in the green. Looking at our integrated electric, again, these are test metrics that we're monitoring during a test period. Pretty consistent with what we've said in Q3. Some of the metrics are jumping in and out of compliance or what the metrics are telling us we're targeting for. But again, that's the test metrics. And they may change in the future as we continue to monitor and learn what this is telling us. So looking at our quarterly investment report, I just want to note that basically all policy objectives are in compliance and being met. The one item I would note that's interesting, if you look at Q4 2018, our actually district yield is below the three-month T-bill. We're above it on year for the 2018 results. This is primarily driven to the fact that, you know, in rising Fed rates, when they kept cranking up the federal rate, you know, the three-month T-bill is basically a 92-day maturity. Our weighted average is, I think, it's just north of 1,000. So it's harder for us to churn our investments to match up with that. But overall, we're still exceeding that three-month T-bill. It's just in that Q4 when not rising environment like that. I'm going to briefly discuss our planned 2019 debt actions. We're contemplating a 2019 Rock Island internal loan from our financing facilities to Rock Island. As we continue to invest money in Rock Island, the investment is beyond what we get from our contractual adder pay mechanism. We have a mechanism that we can leverage our financing facilities cash to fund that for the benefit of meeting those capital needs, and it's financially advantageous for the district. We're going to return to the board in March to present specific terms and request board approval, but we just want to give you some time to think about that. And if you had any questions, to seek us out.
That will be new, so just bring it to your attention here that we haven't done this for quite a while.
Yeah, I think since 2011, I believe. Yeah, and we're also exploring potential refinancing opportunities for saving. We're continuing to evaluate it, and we see some possibilities. And if the opportunities are favorable, we'll return to request board approval later in the year. No specific time frame or definite action determined. So looking at everything all together for 2018, the results are better than budget. I would note that our plans for all those significant capital investments, they're expected to fully utilize our cash reserves. Although our cash reserves are high at the moment, that money's been pretty much earmarked. Our long-term financial policy metrics look good. They're on track. And we basically recommend to stay the course with our strategic goals.
Did you guys compare the net bottom line this year to previous years? How does this one rank?
This is just north of last year. So you take the last 2 years, they are both the highest years on record. I believe this year is $500,000 better than last year. Both north of $105 million. I think one was $105 and one was $105.4. But I could tell you exactly if you... What? Well, I'm going to go to my magic book. So 2017 was $105.0 and 2018 was $105.3. So it is the highest bottom line on record.
It is. Just granted, I don't even have words right now, but thank you. And you know how strange it is that I wouldn't have words. Just happy. Very happy.
Good job. Good job, everyone. Yeah.
Nice work. Very good. Thank you.
It takes a lot of people.
It does, but yeah.
Good team effort. Thank you.
And what a great effort. Give me enough time when I start talking.
And they did it in.
Yeah, it flew right through that.
That was a pretty quick time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Dave, I'm going to actually interrupt for just a moment because Suzanne has a time constraint. So if you wouldn't mind, we're going to try to get Suzanne in. Suzanne, you're going to be asked to do this as quickly as you can. And then if we can, we might run a little bit over, but we'd like to get Dave in before lunch.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Suzanne Grissel with the Government Relations.
This is a manager's item, by the way, that we've moved up to accommodate Suzanne's schedule.
So I just wanted to provide a quick update on the early action effort. We did have a meeting recently with FERC staff to discuss the commission's plans for implementing the American Waters Resource Infrastructure Act. and the early action provision in particular. Our goal was to understand basically how they interpret the new law, if they saw it the same way that we saw it, and how we could facilitate their effective and appropriate implementation of a first test case, which would be Chelan Beauty, hopefully. So we learned pretty quickly that they had not developed any internal processes as of yet. We were the first ones that had come in to talk to them in detail as FERC staff about this. We then proceeded to offer some examples of Chelan PUD projects, had a couple of handouts of basically ongoing or complete actions that we would hope would qualify for early action under the new law. And there was general consensus that they believed that the Rock Island rehabilitation would count. Of course, we have to go through the official process for that, but there was sort of general acknowledgement that that fits into the interpretation of the new law. So the meeting was done to provide clarity around the next steps of how we go about getting that official reaction from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They offered suggestions on that path forward, and they actually agreed to review a draft proposal from us and would take a look at that before we actually officially file that. So internally, PUD staff is working to develop a draft of our first request, and they will be coordinating with FERC on what that looks like and what kind of information needs to be included to get that declaration of whether or not something counts for early action. And once we make that submittal, FERC will have 60 days to give us a response. So overall, I think it was a really good meeting with FERC staff, very cordial. They were very responsive. And I think we're going to have a good working relationship on trying to be a first test case for the new law. Anything to add?
I think that was great. We wanted you to be aware that we have sat down with them. We weren't sure what would happen. You know, how would they react to the fact that we've got a new law here? And the fact it was so positive is very encouraging, particularly because we have this teed up as a strategic planning item.
That's great.
Okay.
Thanks, Suzanne.
I'm just getting happier as we go along.
This is a good day.
It's a really good day.
So I'm going to apologize. I think this next item is relatively short and will take us a little bit beyond normal time, but it'd be nice if we could get Dave through and so he can get on to
other things. He can actually go do something that's worthy.
Okay, I've got four reports to go over as part of our quarterly reporting as part of the delegated authority. The first one is the active major capital projects report. And on these two pages, I would just note that all of the items that are noted as variances for schedule or cost were previously discussed with the board last quarter. Just kind of on a high level, the schedule variances for the Rock Island Powerhouse 1 modernizations due to realignment of the B1 through 4 schedules and delays on B6. We note that the first of the B1 through 4 units is underway. There's some assessments being performed and could potentially have some impacts on the schedule for B4 due to some concerns about the condition of the discharge liner, 85-year-old discharge liner, and the assessments are not yet complete on that. They also had schedule and cost variances for the substation projects, and Rock Island Powerhouse 2 crane projects are on this report. We have a schedule variance for the Rock Island storage building, which is now in service, and a cost variance for the North Mid-Sea Transmission Project. So those are the items that are on this first report. The next report is the capital projects with budget revisions, and being the end of the year, there were a little larger number of revisions than we normally see. In the first section in the green here for the customer utilities, quite a number of revisions, mostly transferring budgets from one project to another, overall a $50,000 increase. I would note there were some large increases in line extensions and customer services here, partially offset by customer contributions. I think Andy Wendell was in talking to the board about that last year, about some of those things, increases in those requests from customers to do that work. In the next section for transmission, just a net zero change, a couple of small revisions. In fiber and telecom, in the purple, we had a large number of revisions, just like I mentioned, adjusting budgets between projects, and in the public power benefit projects, allocating those funds to the different projects that are planned for 2019. For hydros, we had a couple of projects. The Lake Chelan Powerhouse Breaker Project needed an additional $70,000 to add some scope and some additional costs that came into that project, and to purchase a replacement air compressor at Rock Island. Small adjustment in hatcheries, small adjustment in fleet, facilities, the closing of the Ski Badger comm site necessitated a budget revision. We had not budgeted for that, even though we'd been working on that project. Just didn't know what the outcome would be and established the project when the agreement was worked out. And then a net zero change in IT. So overall, $639,000 of increases, net increases over the quarter. The next report is the active contracts greater than $1 million, just highlighting the new ones for the quarter. The first one is the Yakima Nation funding agreement for the Coho project. I would note that that's a long-term agreement, so the $9.7 million is the expected spending over the term of the agreement, which runs through 2032 or 33. On the next page, we have TCF architecture, additional task authorization for the new operations, customer service, and administration center. We have a Strider Construction negotiated contract for the Peshastin wastewater treatment facility improvements. That was brought to the board in August, actually, and then negotiated and entered into a contract. It's actually attached on the back here in... Have the date on here, but it was in the next month. It was in September that it was negotiated. Next one is the ThyssenKrupp elevator contract. This was for a district elevator modernization project. It was done underneath the National Cooperative Purchasing Alliance, and this is for four elevators at Rock Island, four at Rocky Reach, and one here at headquarters. On the next page, we have. This is a replacement purchase contract with Nokia, actually. Nokia was purchased from Alcatel, and so this is a contract that was in place before with Alcatel, originally 11 of 2017, but now into Nokia's name in this new purchase contract. And then on the last page, a number of new services contracts through our agreement with PEER, which the agreement with PEER was approved by the board in November 2018. And then on the last page, we tracked negotiated contracts that were active or agreed upon during the quarter, and we had one. That was the contract for the Peshastin wastewater treatment facility improvements with Strider Construction.
And that was reported to the board earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That was September 4th. So any questions about any of those things?
Nope. I think we're good.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the additional 5 minutes so we can get through that. That's what we had.
Dave, thank you morning. Very much.
Well, no more questions from the board. We will recess and begin our business session at 1 o'clock. Good afternoon, and welcome to the February 19, 2019 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commissioner meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices that you may have. We welcome all of our visitors today, and we place great value on the public's input at our meetings. And since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone, please state your name and address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda, and Mr. Wright, you want to move forward with this consent agenda?
Yeah, I'd like to just ask if there are anyone here who would like to comment on items 14, 15, and 16, which have to do with cryptocurrency rates and policies. I'm asking that question, although I'm looking around and I'm not seeing any member of the public other than PUD staff at the moment in the room, so just in case. Test that, and if not, then I would suggest we move forward with the consent agenda.
All right. So, commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed signify by saying no. The ayes have it. Consent agenda carries. We're now moving on to the regular agenda. And Steve, would you like to present the regular agenda?
I would. I'd like to move to item 13, which is one of our lessons learned, agendas from the consent agenda. If I pop C back up. This is a project that is very visible to the public. Thought it would be of interest to the board to see where it came from and how it's turned out.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. My name is Bob Seebeck. I'm a construction manager for Engineering and Project Management Group. I also supervise our GIS drafting and survey group. So I'm, as Steve said, I'm presenting a lessons learned from District Bid 18-15. That was the BB Bridge boat launch and dock replacement. This work was completed late in 2018. All the in-water work was done in performed in October as per the permit requirements, and KRCI Contracting of East Wenatchee was the low bidder out of the six bids received. So these lessons learned that I want to talk about consist of changes we've made to these launch facilities over the last 28 and a half years. And the reason I know it's been 28 and a half years because I was the inspector in the BB Bridge and Chelan Falls Park were built, and I saw this work go in then, and now we've upgraded that. So
you're making both of us feel old.
I do as well. This is a picture of the right across the river from BB Bridge at Chelan Falls boat launch. We replaced it in 2017, but this was just a good photo to show some of the damages that we'd had there. You see the precast planks, they're cracked, crumbling apart. We're missing part of them. There's rebar and steel exposed. Those were bolted together with a piece of flat bar, but there was that gap in between those precast planks. And that gap then created a lot of problems for us. So you can imagine you back your trailer in, and as you're going to then get your boat up onto the trailer, a lot of folks gun it, and that prop wash digs a big hole underneath those precast planks. It was hard to get a photo of that, but so that's been a problem. So then this erosion underneath the planks, and we get some deflection and cracking and things. So today you can see these are what we used at BB Bridge. They're much thicker, the much stronger planks. You can hopefully see there that we use a tongue and groove so we can fit those together, and there is no gap now in between those planks. This turn-down leg, that's that leg on the side there, that protects the launch down both sides from any wave action erosion coming underneath from the sides. Hopefully you can see this. This is then in place with the new planks, and there is, again, there is no gap in between there, so we got a nice solid foundation and then a launch ramp all the way down both sides.
May I ask, Bob, who does the precast on those?
Well, those were precast up in Bellingham.
In Bellingham.
Yeah.
Okay.
And trucked over.
Okay. Thank you.
So the docks are no longer constructed of wood like you you remember in the first photo. They're all aluminum with welded frames. They have ADA-approved grading on them. They also meet all the fish light requirements. We need to get 65% light through that dock to underneath that dock so the bad fish can't hide there in the shadows. It's also greatly reduced maintenance for park staff with this aluminum. There is no replacing wood planks or screws and that type of thing. Here you can see this is a good before and after at BB Bridge. There on the left side, the unsightly tires. And now we've added a gangway. We've reduced the number of docks from 5 down to 3 and then added that gangway. Again, the gangway is ADA approved. It's got ADA-approved grading, got the light passage. The reason these first two docks on the left normally sat high and dry all year round. When the park was originally designed, there was thoughts of a 3-foot pool raise. So that design criteria was built in, and that's why that abutment is built to that elevation, and that's why we were able now to remove the two of those docks. So in all, we've now got ADA approved gangway and docks. We've really reduced the maintenance cost for the parks. We've got fish friendly dock and gangway facilities. We've eliminated the crop wash, and we've also eliminated any freeze thaw and deflection issues we've had in the past. So, is there any questions?
That's a great boat launch.
Thank you.
It really is a nice boat.
Well, wait, I'm sorry. I have one more before and after too.
There it is.
sorry to sneak that one in.
So was that taken 27 and a half years ago?
Well, not quite, but about 26, I believe. Yeah,
I had a kid in school who looked a lot.
Yes,
like
you
that.
Did. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. Let me quickly get out of that.
But I believe we had about the same length of hair.
We might have.
And I had a handlebar and contacts. We were both pretty groovy.
Yeah. Yes, we were.
Uh-huh. Nice job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Next up, Agenda 17 is a resolution amending Resolution 18-14243, declaring Boyth Hydro Incorporated of York, Pennsylvania as the sole source supplier for blade trunnion seals, seal covers, and blade bushings necessary to repair Rocky Reach Units C1 through C7, and authorizing the general manager to purchase additional blade bushings with Boyth Hydro Incorporated for a revised price. It's a bit of a complicated little change to a resolution, so Brett is here to describe it.
Good afternoon, Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. And so, yes, this is a resolution amending the price for blade bushings that was originally authorized under Resolution 18-14243. When we prepared the resolution back in May, well, we did some estimating on what the cost for these parts would be if we bought a large quantity of them, and so we established the resolution in that manner. We purchased one set of blade trunnion seals, covers, and blade bushings for Unit C1, and we were able to purchase those within the authorized amount. We're projecting that we need to have another set on hand so that we can be able to rapidly recover and be able to install in case we have any oil leaks on future units. And so we issued a field work order to Voith to go ahead and purchase some more blade bushings and seals. And they responded back that their costs were quite a bit higher to produce the blade bushings, so they wouldn't be able to supply for the same price that was in the resolution. And so we worked with them to diligently come up with what would be a fair and equitable price going forward. And so now that's what we're presenting today.
Commissioners, any questions?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Sounds like we got a really good deal on the first set.
We did.
Yeah, well, good work.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Ready for vote.
Okay. So, commissioners, we're going to vote on resolution items. Do we want to move this into a, well, I guess we don't move that to the proposed motion on board workshop. Move it together?
No, let's
keep it separately.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
All those in favor of resolution item?
Of resolution what?
Of the resolution item.
So not if I move and then we'll vote?
Yes.
Should we do that?
So we should move. Thank you.
So I move to approve resolution number 17, resolution amending... as stated, I'm just going to say that. Does that work?
Perfect.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. And the ayes have it.
With that, I think we're ready to turn to additional manager items. We have three. I'm going to invite Justin Erickson to come up.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of Public Services. I'd like to update you on two items this afternoon, Tumwater Dam and then strategic planning. It was back in December that I came to you to report on Tumwater and let you know that we were going to do some exploratory drilling and that we had some concerns related to erosion and potentially a need to make some timely repairs before spring runoff. We have now done that drilling and analyzed the results and determined that we that the erosion was not as extensive as we feared. The tremie layer of concrete, which is the kind of the base layer that's put in the water, was not as thick, and so our repairs that we were anticipating were some micro piles, and those will not work given that limited layer of tremie base. However, that erosion is less than we thought, and so we believe that we can. There is no imminent threat to the infrastructure, and so we will be moving forward then with a more extensive review and analysis of the dam, the fishway, and that viewing platform later in the fall as part of our maintenance analysis and work. So at this time, there is no need to expend those additional funds or do that work. We're hopeful that through this more extensive investigation later in the year that we can determine, have a good baseline, understand exactly where we're at, and then we can do a monitoring and a maintenance plan and make further analysis based on that data.
So, Justin, is the area of erosion, is that on the far side? I've driven by there. It's not on, is it, or is it by the side where the road goes past the Tumwater?
No, this area that we were talking at, looking at now, it was along the roadside, right where the fishway is and that viewing platform, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Right transition?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Strategic planning, of course, as you know, we had a kickoff event on February 7th. We had around 71 was our final headcount, not including commissioners or PUD staff. Received some good feedback on that event. We had a number of people that participated in the breakout sessions, the topic team events. I think what was also very informative was the number of people that were not able to stay that afternoon, and so indicated to us that they wanted to serve on a team but just couldn't stay that afternoon, or those that wanted to serve on more than one team. And so that totaled about 21 individuals. So all told, moving forward with the topic team process, those teams are going to range in size probably from around 9 to 18 people, so average size of 13. And so for the next 90 days or so, those teams will be doing their work somewhat autonomously, but understanding the kind of the overall framework and timeline. And then, of course, we'll be cognizant of the overall project time frame. We'll be looking at a May-June time frame for the extensive customer owner outreach that we have planned, and which will include additional presentations. So to date, we've done, I think, 15 presentations before city councils, community councils, civic organizations, et cetera. And we will be taking a bit of a pause here over this 90-day period while we undertake the topic team work, and then we'll finish this process out doing additional presentations. So if you know of groups or organizations that would like to hear from us, please let me know and we'll get those scheduled. We do have one scheduled already in late May, which is with the Chelan Rotary Club. We also did want to note that our website is now live and updated to include the video that you saw at the event, along with all of the presentation materials. That website is also dynamic and switches to Spanish for our Spanish-speaking customer owners as well. Be happy to answer any questions you have on where we're at and where we're headed with strategic planning.
Sounds good.
All right, thank you.
Just want to add one other quick item to we are planning to do survey work for two of the areas, the aesthetic area and the growth economic development arena. And so you Should have an email from me actually just sent over the lunch hour that gives you an opportunity to let us know if you have any concerns or thoughts about the survey. We spent a lot of time working with our consultant on this. So we're kind of at the end, but we wanted you to have a quick look so you hopefully don't get surprised if you hear people about people being surveyed. But also, if there's anything in there that strikes you as, boy, that's not going to be useful or helpful.
Is it possible to get a copy since I was gone of the video?
Yes, sir. I'll email you a link.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, I want to invite Kim Craig to talk about a Firewise event that's coming up.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Kimberly Craig from Communications. I would like to invite you and your family members and neighbors to the now third annual Firewise event at Pybus Market this coming Saturday. It's between 10 and 1 p.m. And there's a couple of significant expansions from the first two days. This is an event sponsored by local fire districts, supported by AAA Insurance, and Chelan PUD is also a significant sponsor. Helps people prepare for wildfire, both landscaping and all kinds of land use and water planning, wise water use. And this year we're doing a lot more to involve students in the event, have invited STEM teachers and their students, and we're providing a large hands-on science activity center in the new activity center at Pybus Market. So it's a nice chance to highlight that. I'll be there with some information about our grubbing and painting efforts that we do on our transmission lines. You may recall that really great picture that we had during the Aniat Canyon fire last year, where our pole was nearly untouched while all the ground around it was scorched. So that's a good example of that. And then we're also continuing to take the public opportunities to talk about the dangers of downed lines. Our operation folks continue to be concerned that folks, they want to help us, so they see a line on the ground, and they think that might be a good idea to move it, and we want to stress the fact that it always to assume that it's energized. And also our arborist, Bill Sandberg, noted that he comes upon a scene often where people are trying to pull out limbs and trees to help us, and we would like to stress also that just stay far away, and we'll take care of the trees, and we'll be there to restore the power. So I hope to see you there. Thank you.
What time is that, Kim?
It's 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, February 23rd at Pybus Market. Look forward to seeing you there.
Great. Thank you.
So I think that's it for manager items. We are ready for agenda item 19.
Okay. Commissioners, we have a proposed motion. Would the commissioner like to entertain that motion?
Like to move to set a special meeting on April 11th, 2009 at 9 a.m. at Confluence Technology Center for the purpose of holding a board workshop.
Second.
Motion has been moved.
Second.
Seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the proposed motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Jason, commissioner items?
What's that, Randy?
You got a spot for additional commissioner items?
Yes, let me, the ayes have it. Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to share with Steve and Dennis that next week, Gary and I will be going to the APPA fly-in. And one of the things that emerged this past week was the desire of Chelan PUD to add its support to a resolution that will be put forth at the fly-in relating to National Forest funding for management of forest health to help prevent catastrophic fires. So Gary will be the one putting our name as a co-sponsor. This resolution was brought forward by several California utilities as a result of all the catastrophic wildfires that have been occurring there and the potential liability that exists out there for utilities in this arena. So just wanted our fellow commissioners to be aware we are doing that, as is the PUD Association.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
That's good. Thank you, Randy. Are there any other commissioner items? But follow up with delegation.
We had four from the last meeting. So first of all, to provide information on the City of San Diego's undergrounding plan, John Stoll sent that email a couple of weeks ago, actually. Mike Coleman did make changes to his strategic planning presentation on public power benefit to capture the mission statement as requested. And Justin has provided a list of service clubs that have received the strategic planning presentation. So those three are complete. We're still gathering some information on early action credit, what constitutes a nexus with the Rock Island project, and what past lists of projects included for you. Hopefully by next meeting we'll have something for you on that. And that's it. Okay.
Anything from today?
I have one, just that Justin will email the link to the strategic planning video to Commissioner Bowles.
Thank you.
Do we have any additional public comments? Seeing no public, the answer to that is no. How about any matters of general business that may be necessary come before the commission? None? Okay. Well, we need an executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW. 90 minutes?
Let's go with 90 minutes. Yes, please.
We'll have 90 minutes for executive session. We're coming out of executive session. It is February 19th. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we are adjourned.